Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. At times, it's becoming hard to come by plumbing fixtures, construction materials, salad dressing, even some new books, you name it. Shortages, higher prices, fewer choices, and frequent references to supply chain issues. What are these supply chain issues, and why, more than a year and a half into the pandemic, do they keep popping up in so many corners of our lives? Professor Tom Goldsby chairs logistics at the Haslam College of Business, University of Tennessee, Knoxville. He's immediate past co-editor-in-chief of the Journal of Business Logistics and former co-editor-in-chief of Transportation Journal, and he's here to help us sort out what is happening and get a sense of what to expect. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Goldsby.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's great to be with you.
And this might seem pretty simple, that what we're talking about here, supply chain, is the process of moving stuff from point A to point B. But lately, we've been getting quite a hard lesson on how much more complex than that it really is. Briefly, if you can, could you tell us, how did we get here where we are?
Well, it's been quite a long journey. But it is very complex.
It is, yes.
And I think the people need to appreciate that it is more than the moving of a product from point A to B. There has to be a product in the first place. And so we have to concern ourselves with how and where we make that product. And most products have a lot of different inputs that go into them. And so we then need to source materials and various inputs then to have a product or even a service that we're going to provide to some end user. And so we really break supply chain management down in terms of planning for everything you need to coordinate. And then on the execution side of things, there's the source, make, and deliver functionality. And oh, by the way, don't forget that a lot of those products that end up in the hands of consumers like you and me end up coming back through returns. And so there's also the return process that we have to concern ourselves with too. So we think of it in those five basic functions: plan, source, make, deliver, and return. And increasingly, these supply chains are getting stretched around the world, as we're all appreciating. It's not that everything you want to buy is sourced locally, and then those products rely on sources of supply that are quite far away. And generally speaking, when you have to cover a long distance, there are a lot of things, usually not good, that can happen between point A and B when you're trying to assemble all those inputs to make a product in the first place.
Well, there's been a ton of reporting about the supply chain. It's ongoing. It's like a moving target. But one of the things that we see frequently is that during this pandemic, people have been trying to buy more stuff than ever before. And conversely, going with what you just said, sending back stuff at levels not seen in the past. And the demand is outstripping the supply chain's capacity, seems to be a problem. Is that your assessment of the situation?
Tom, it seems like you've got a great handle on this situation. I think most people right now are wanting to point fingers, and they're pointing fingers at the supply chain. But as you recognize, the situation really is a function of demand, simply outpacing the capacity that we have in the supply chain. And as you point out, we're spending, you know, quite a bit of money on stuff these days. Ordinarily, supply chains would have an opportunity to catch their breath a little bit during the summer months, even into the fall. But that really wasn't possible because people weren't spending their money on travel and experiences. Rather, they were spending it on stuff, durables, and so many of those products coming from overseas. And so that's why we then rely on, you know, in particular, Asian suppliers, Chinese suppliers then to put those products on the water, get them to our West Coast ports, which is the shortest distance to the United States market, and then offload those at ports, particularly Long Beach and LA, and get those containers then moving inland to places like Kentucky. And we have just been facing a shortage in every segment of that transportation. From even the export port locations in Asia are lacking capacity of getting those containers. They're lacking, in fact, sufficient containers right now to load and get en route to the United States. And then once the product lands here in the U.S., well, I think the snarl on the West Coast ports has been very well documented. still more than 60 ships sitting off the coast of Southern California waiting for the opportunity to come ashore and offload those containers. And once you get on U.S. shore, you then have to transport by means of truck or rail or a combination of those two. And we've been facing shortage in both of those, largely because of trucks and trains and labor. And I'm sure we'll be talking more about labor later, but it's just a function that everything is overstressed right now by virtue of the demand we're facing.
Well, we know that this disruption is affecting shipments of just about everything from like canned seltzer, the paper used to make books, all kinds of auto parts, not to mention electronics and a lot of the stuff that we tend to buy right now as the holidays approach. But are there any particular sectors that are being hit harder than others, or is this situation spread pretty evenly across the economy?
Well, I think of products that are largely produced domestically from domestic supplies. And dare I say, many of the grocery items that we buy would fit into that situation. We really shouldn't be seeing tremendous runs on those products. But I do think that there's a bit of a hyper anxiety out there around these things. We experienced it early in the pandemic with toilet paper, cleaning supplies, and some food products. And I think the consumer's just a little oversensitive to the prospects of running out of these things. We really, the wholly domestic supply chains are functioning at a pretty high level. We would like to have more capacity that's probably constrained based on labor to make more product and warehouse more product and transport it. But those wholly domestic supply chains performing quite well and should really be able to keep pace with demand. It's as soon as you start relying on external sources of supply that things start to get a little bit more hamstrung as you start to try to rely on the bottleneck that is, you know, the ports of LA and Long Beach. You've seen some pretty extended delays there. One issue that I've been paying particular close attention to, and I think the folks in Central Kentucky can probably appreciate this, is automotive. As you recognize, we're behaving differently in the pandemic than we did pre-pandemic. And even though the automotive industry saw a pretty sharp decline in the early days of the pandemic, people weren't going anywhere. And so there was no need for personal transportation to drive to work or vacation or whatnot during shutdowns. But pretty soon thereafter, people realized, well, I don't want to take public transit. I may not be flying. And so incredible demand for personal automobiles. I think it's been well documented, both new cars, used cars. You hear of people that are actually selling used cars for more than they paid for them, which is mind-boggling to me. Uh-huh. But one of the big hinge points there is the semiconductors. And I have to admit, I've become educated on just how many chips go into making a modern automobile. I've asked my students this question, how many semiconductor chips do you think it takes to support the propulsion, automation, the entertainment, the navigation, the braking systems? And, you know, I routinely hear students say, oh, I don't know, 10, 20. It's like, try over 1,000.
No kidding.
And so when you realize that each and every one of those automobiles has over 1,000 chips, you start to realize, gee, that can be a real, a real constraint when everyone's fighting tooth or nail for a limited supply.
Uh-huh. And I know that Bloomberg has reported a disruption in the movement of natural rubber, which was already falling into short supply due to stockpiling by China. There's been a serious leaf disease. And rubber is, of course, widely used in manufacturing all kinds of things. So this would seem to kind of give us a great example of how a supply chain disruption can have a domino effect that's likely to be felt by our listeners. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I have to admit, you've educated me with regard to that example of rubber. I have been watching things like steel, as well as the semiconductor example I just gave earlier. You know, particularly when you see competition for common sources of supply, as you would with steel, rubber, semiconductors, you find that competition is not limited merely to your head-to-head rivals within your industry. So it's not just Toyota versus Honda versus GM. Suddenly, they're competing for semiconductors, to go back to that example, with the game console makers, right? They're competing with Sony and Microsoft for these game systems. And frankly, even though Toyota, Honda, and GM are massive automotive manufacturers, they haven't traditionally been, you know, major consumers, buyers of semiconductor chips. So the likes of Intel could just kind of consider, say, GM as, you know, just another account, as opposed to a Sony or Microsoft that is a massive account because they're co-developing these chips together. They've got highly intertwined supply chains and a lot of codependence. And so the automakers have had to get pretty savvy about how they can meet their needs when they're competing not only with other automakers, but increasingly with companies far and wide and in very different segments of the economy.
Yeah, and it's hitting them as they're trying to deal with a pretty revolutionary pivot from the internal combustion engine to EVs, to electric vehicles. So an awful lot of turmoil there.
And it's going to require that many more semiconductors to run those kinds of systems too.
Uh-huh.
You know, as soon as we start to have more autonomous vehicles, you know, guess what's going to happen to the number of semiconductors to build and maintain an automobile that's running on computers, in essence.
Yeah. What about all the costs associated with keeping things stored while they wait for transit? Fees on trucks having to wait for longer periods to get loaded or unloaded. Are those costs eating away margins, and should we expect to see prices continue rising? They're already bumping up as a result of this imbalance between supply and demand.
Well, it is costing more to move product from point A to B. Again, whenever you have a shortage, you can expect the final variable to be price, and it's going to head upward. And so as we see a shortage in drivers, which we've had actually for many, many years, driver wage rates are having to go up in order to attract anything approaching sufficient talent levels to move that product. Also, when product's not moving in warehouses, we've not been able to keep pace with building new warehouse and storage locations. And so rents are going up, vacancies are going down as a result, and we're just seeing very finite capacities out there. And again, that final variable is going to be price. The companies that are moving and storing stuff are paying a higher price, and probably eventually it's going to be passed along to the consumer, ultimately, in higher prices that we pay for virtually everything.
Are you hearing whether this situation is forcing companies to come to terms and deal with internal inefficiencies and waste, and are those that don't do that going to struggle on the other side of all of this?
Well, I think that global competition for several years has forced the hand of companies that were grossly inefficient. Tom, I think you and I have talked in years past about lean thinking, and I know lean has been thrown under the bus quite a bit in recent months over the last couple of years, as it would apply to having too little inventory. But lean thinking at its essence is continuous improvement and trying to figure out better ways to serve the customer and yes, do so at a lower cost. And so I think global competition has forced many companies' hands to squeeze out inefficiencies. But there's still some, you know, product categories out there with healthy margins, but gee, they face pressure from their shareholders to continue delivering on those margin expectations. So, you know, companies have to get pretty savvy. I think that logistics has been largely regarded as a cost of doing business. And for a typical product, it might only be 5% of sales. And during a typical season, it might ebb up a point or two. And maybe be a little bit detrimental to margins. But what we're seeing now is that logistics and larger supply chain management are very much C-suite concerns. It's a function of, can we not just move the product or store the product and have it cost a little bit more, but now we're facing a situation where that's not a given that you're going to be able to move the product or store the product. And it's not a given that it's a small incremental increase in the price paid. It can be very substantial. And so, you know, those of us in supply chain are saying, hey, you know, we need to seize the opportunity here. There's all these eyes cast on supply chain right now. And, you know, frankly, a fair bit of blame being directed towards supply chain management, but we need to turn it into a positive and say, hey, this is the means by which you compete moving forward. It's not the simple proposition that most people believe it is.
The columnist Paul Krugman has written that the biggest thing that could bring fast relief would be undoing the skew in demand by making people feel safe again about buying more services, more experiences, which is the direction we were going in, and fewer goods, fewer stuff, which would seem to bring us all the way back around to the beginning of this whole thing. And that is that the way to do this is by getting the pandemic under control.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. Frankly, if we were to have been talking 6 months ago, mm-hmm. when we had a vaccine that was in production and seeing distribution and usage, I frankly see it as a pretty solvable problem if vaccines had been adopted to the level they could have been. I think Delta would have been much more muted, and we'd kind of be moving on with the pandemic very much akin to what the flu represents. However, we all know what happened, and as a result, Delta was much more virulent and unfortunately for us, effective. And we had a wave that went through the summer into the fall and continues. And I agree with Krugman that if we could get this pandemic more muted, we could get about to living life in a more similar semblance to what we enjoyed before the pandemic, and it would be going out and experiencing things, traveling and going to movies and games and things that, you know, frankly, myself, I'm not anywhere close to consuming on par with where I was in 2019. So, you know, a lot of those things still rely on goods, physical and items and durables, many of which would be sourced overseas, but it would greatly alleviate the strain on the supply chain system if we would just consume in a similar manner to what we did pre-pandemic.
Well, meantime, it sure would be good to get back to those times that you were just talking about, to get out there and experience life. Professor Tom Goldsby chairs logistics at the Haslam College of Business, University of Tennessee, Knoxville. And thank you so much for spending time with us here to help us sort this out, because it's affecting us all day by day.
Absolutely, Tom. It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Appreciate you looking me up.
You have too much stuff. Too much stuff. Too much stuff. You never get enough, 'cause there's just too much stuff. You know you can hurt yourself fooling with too much stuff. Yeah, it'll tear you down fooling with all that stuff. That's a lot of stuff.
44% of Kentucky's adult population is not participating in the workforce, and that's more than 1.5 million Kentucky adults. As of this past June, Kentucky had the third lowest workforce participation rate in the country, just slightly ahead of West Virginia and Mississippi. And while you may have heard reports that the number of people quitting their jobs has surged to record highs, Kentucky's issues with workforce participation predate the pandemic. The Kentucky Chamber Foundation has released a 32-page report titled 20 Years in the Making, Kentucky's Work Crisis. And joining us to talk about what that report says is its author, Charles Aull, Senior Policy Analyst at the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce. Welcome, Charles.
Thanks for having me.
And first, terminology. What is important to understand when we're talking about workforce in the context of economic data?
Great question. Workforce is a term that we all throw around on a really frequent basis. And essentially what we're talking about when we talk about labor force or workforce is the number of individuals who are employed, but it also includes individuals that are unemployed. And in economics terms, unemployed means something very specific. It doesn't just mean you don't have a job, but it means that you are somebody who currently doesn't have a job but is actively looking for a job. So we take that employment number and then that unemployment number and combine those together, and that's how we get our workforce number. Now, any folks that fall outside of that, they're just simply outside of the workforce altogether.
So what does your latest data tell you about how many Kentucky adults are neither working nor actively out there looking for work?
Yeah, and that's the big question. That's the thing that we're kind of most interested in trying to understand. During the height of the pandemic, your first 3 or 4 months when things were really, really bad, in Kentucky, we saw about 112,000 individuals completely exit the workforce. And so that means they were not employed and they were not looking for work. They were just completely outside of that workforce. Since then, we've only had about 22,000 people come back, which is a very disturbing number when you think about it, because that means we're roughly 90,000 workers short of where we were prior to the pandemic. Now, that's something that nearly every state in the nation is dealing with, but it's a particularly bad problem in Kentucky, because as our report highlights, workforce participation was already an issue before we got to the pandemic. So we were already having low rates of workforce participation, meaning that we have a small number of our adult population who actually works. Unfortunately, when the pandemic hit, that problem got significantly worse. And this is one of the reasons why you're seeing so many issues with employers having trouble finding workers. We literally have less workers than we did prior to the start of the pandemic.
Well, what do the numbers tell you about Kentucky's work rate for prime working age adults? These are people in their post-college but pre-retirement years, between 25 and 54 years of age.
Yeah, great question, Tom. So kind of stepping back a little bit, when we talk about the larger workforce participation rate, that includes all adults above the age of 16 or older. And now there's a few exclusions in there, people who are in active duty military service, incarcerated individuals. We don't include those in that number. But that larger workforce participation number, that includes everyone from 16 on up. So if you're 90 years old, we're kind of factoring in you into that population. But one of the age groups that we spend a lot of time talking about is the prime age worker. So that's roughly individuals between the ages of 25 and 64. You've probably graduated college at that point, but you haven't quite hit Medicaid eligibility, so you're more than likely to be working during that time. And so we did take a close look at this group, and one of the things that we found was that the percentage of prime age working individuals has been in a steady state of decline over about the past 20 years or so. What's more problematic in Kentucky, though, is that the actual number of prime age workers that we have available is actually decreasing. So we're actually seeing a decrease in the work rate of that work group, but the overall size of that group is also getting bigger. And that's a big problem for Kentucky, and that's something we're going to have to think about long term.
Well, you know, one of the really interesting characteristics of this pandemic that kind of began emerging early and it's accelerated is how it has revealed things. And I'm wondering, how has the pandemic accelerated those pre-existing trends that you talked about and even magnified our weaknesses?
Yeah, there's a few different ways that you can talk about that and a few different things that it kind of highlighted in terms of problems, larger labor force problems. Good example of this is we have an aging population. Retirements were something that were already happening well before the pandemic started. In fact, if you go back to about 2012, you can take a look at our baby boomer generation, and we were seeing about 2 million boomers retire every single year. Well, when the pandemic hit, there was a lot of incentive, particularly if you're an older individual, a lot of incentive to get out of the workforce and stop working for a whole bunch of different reasons. One, the economy was very iffy, but there were also actual health risks and still are to individuals that are older. And so a lot of those folks retired. And in fact, you know, I mentioned, you know, we saw about 2 million of those boomers retire starting from about 2012 up to 2019. In 2020, we saw roughly around 3.2 million boomers retire. So that's a really big chunk of your workforce that just suddenly disappeared. And so that really put a squeeze on a problem that we knew was coming down the road, but it really accelerated it. Another example that we can point to of sort of how the pandemic exacerbated pre-existing problems is with our childcare sector. A lot of working parents are only able to work if they are able to find a place or a service that can watch their children while they're working. Well, that childcare sector was already very vulnerable, very unstable prior to the start of the pandemic. But when the pandemic hit, a lot of these services closed. A lot of them had to scale back the services that they provided. And so that put a huge strain on particularly working women, mothers. And we saw a big drop in the number of women who are participating in the workforce. And we can connect that very, very closely to the impact that this pandemic had on the childcare sector. And so that's another way that this pandemic just shone a light on a lot of the bigger problems that we were already dealing with before the pandemic even started.
There's a popular notion out there that those recent pandemic stimulus payments that you mentioned encouraged people not to work. And I'm wondering if the data that you work with is able to confirm that? Is it too soon to know? What do you know about that?
Yeah, so that conversation has been a really interesting one, because usually these very nuanced economic public policy conversations like this, where we're trying to understand the full impact of a particular program, these are things that are taking place in, you know, academic journals, in sort of academic debates, and that's kind of how these things are being figured out. But this is one of those debates that's kind of played out in the public sphere where everybody's talking about it. And so it's been kind of an interesting debate. I think the best answer to that question is kind of a disappointing one, which is we really just don't have great data at this point to confirm one way or the other about what impact those unemployment benefits had at the federal level, the federal unemployment benefits. There's, a couple things people point to. Online job search activity, that's one way you can try to measure this. Now, that's, of course, recording real-time data. However, that's only capturing job searches that are happening online. So it's not capturing job searches where, you know, I walk up to you, Tom, and ask if I can get a job. So it's, you know, it's not going to capture that. Mm-hmm. The data that we work with in this report is mostly macroeconomic data. This is very, very large data sets that cover a whole lot of ground. And it's really hard to identify very specific movements based on specific policy changes or public policy programs. So we're really not going to get a good sense of that for probably several more months, maybe even years, and it'll require a lot of academic analysis. With that being said, the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank did release some analysis where they were thinking they were seeing a positive impact on employment when some of these early states pulled out of the unemployment program before the September deadline. But again, that's just one piece of academic work. We're going to need a whole lot more data before we can come to any firm conclusions.
Elliott County in eastern Kentucky, in your report, is shown to have the lowest workforce participation rate in the state, about 28%. So any idea what the other 72% are doing to keep food on the table and roofs over their heads?
Elliott County is certainly very, very low when it comes to workforce participation, but it's not on an island. A lot of our rural areas throughout Kentucky, particularly in the eastern part of the state, but also a few counties in the western part of the state, have exceptionally low workforce participation rates. On the other side of that coin, we do have other counties. Boone County, for example, has a workforce participation rate of roughly 70%, which is a very, very high rate of work amongst adults. In terms of that 70% in Elliott County that aren't participating in the workforce and how they might be supporting themselves, that could play out in a whole bunch of different ways. Government transfer payments is certainly going to play a big role in that. And by government transfer payments, I'm talking about social safety net programs. There's been some analysis done. Kentucky relies on government transfer payments at a very, very high rate in comparison to the rest of the nation. We're about the fourth or fifth highest, I believe. So a good chunk of these people could be subsisting based on various types of Social Security disability insurance, Medicaid, various other types of government programs that are out there. But, you know, there's lots of other ways that you can get by without working. You might have a family member that's able to support you. You might be living off charity. There's a variety of different ways that people are able to get by. I think the bigger question that we need to figure out is who in this population is dealing with some sort of barrier that might prevent them from working, whether that's a substance abuse issue, maybe it's a transportation issue, maybe it's a criminal background issue. And in terms of policy, we need to be making sure we're pursuing policies that can remove those barriers and get those people into the workforce so they can be actively supporting themselves and supporting their own families.
You note in the report that even more concerning than having fewer adults in the workforce than almost every other state in the country is that once our workforce is restored to a pre-pandemic level, it's likely that it will remain far behind surrounding states in the country. How come?
Yeah, that's a really critical thing for us to be asking, because a lot of people keep saying, we just need to get back to normal. We need to get back to normal and then everything will be better. Well, in the context of Kentucky's labor force, getting back to normal means we're still probably going to be in the bottom 10 for labor force participation. And I think one of the big reasons for that is because we haven't tackled some of these big systemic issues that are dragging down our workforce participation rate in Kentucky. health is a major factor in workforce participation, and Kentucky performs very, very poorly when it comes to various national health rankings. So if you're looking at cardiovascular disease, heart disease, obesity, a whole range of different ailments, and those are big long-term problems. We've known about them for a long time, but what I don't think enough people have connected the dots with is how health intersects with workforce participation and the ability to work. We also need to do more to just in general increase our population. The most recent census that we looked at, Kentucky is not growing nearly as fast as a lot of other states. In fact, our growth rate was lower than the national average. And so we need to do things that will attract more people to live here, more people to want to work here. And at the Chamber, we think one of the great ways to do that is to build a more attractive tax code. People like to move to places that have very attractive tax codes. That's one of the reasons you've seen such significant growth in a place like Tennessee, where they have a very attractive tax code if you're a worker. But there's a whole range of other systemic issues that we talk about in the report, substance abuse issues, criminal records and how a criminal record can prohibit you from accessing a job, how poor transportation and poor infrastructure, lack of access to broadband. We have a whole host of different issues that frankly every state in the nation deals with, but a lot of them are just particularly bad here in Kentucky. And what we need to do is from a public policy level is to start heading these off one at a time and addressing these issues. And ultimately over time, we think we can increase that workforce participation rate. That's a good thing for Kentucky, and it's a good thing for Kentuckians.
Well, at the top of page 14 in this report is the question, what does this all mean? So how do you respond to that question, Charles?
Yeah. Why should we care about low workforce participation?
Exactly.
Low workforce participation rates? Why exactly does that matter? Well, it means a few different things. When you have low workforce participation, that means we're going to have fewer individuals that are paying taxes, that are contributing to your local, your state sales tax base. And that's a really important thing because we use those dollars for a whole lot of important government programs and other types of initiatives like education and paying off pension debts and a whole range of different things that we really need to do as a state to kind of get our house in order. On top of that, though, low work rates are red flags for a lot of prospective businesses. So if you're an employer that's maybe based in another state and you're thinking about opening a business or opening a new location or a new plant in another state, you take a look at these things. And states want to move to places that have strong workforce participation rates because they know they can find the workers. But also on a more social level, there's a lot of strong connection social science work out there that talks about the importance to, you know, mental health, personal identity when it comes to working. Working gets you out of the house. It helps you interact with more people. You know, my wife and I joke all the time that if I didn't have a job, she would probably be the only person that I talk to. And that's not an ideal situation for either of us. So work is it's economically important, but there's also a strong social element to it that's very, very important, I think. And that's one of the reasons why this is a big issue that we all need to care about.
All right, you can find the full report and read it online on the Chamber site at kychamber.com or on our site, esweku.org. Charles Aull, Senior Policy Analyst at the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce. Thank you, Charles.
Thanks, Tom. Have a good one.
Coming up after the break, the decline of chemo.
I think across almost all tumor types, the use of chemotherapy is going down.
The rise of gene editing CRISPR technology.
There are tremendous business implications, commercial implications, but also societal implications and ethical implications with regards to how this powerful technology should or should not be used.
Plus, local artists pay tribute to Stevie Wonder. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Wendy Barnett with the Undermain Arts Minute, bringing you local and regional arts news and events. Two Lexington musical events on November 12th highlight the fall return of live music performances in Central Kentucky. Origins Jazz Series features tenor saxophonist Greg Tardy and his quartet. Tardi is renowned for performing with jazz luminaries like Bill Frisell and Elvin Jones. For more information, go to originsjazz.org. And the Troubadour Concert Series presents John Cowan of Newgrass Revival fame and now performing with the Doobie Brothers, along with bluegrass musicians Darren and Brooke Aldridge. Brooke Aldridge has won the International Bluegrass Music Association Female Vocalist of the Year award multiple times. Go to troubashow.com for more information. For in-depth writing about Kentucky and the region's arts and culture, go to undermain.art. Subscription to Undermain's newsletter can be found on the website. I'm Wendy Barnett with the Undermain Arts Minute for WEKU's Eastern Standard. Now, back to Eastern Standard and Tom Martin.
You hear it often when the conversation turns to cancer. Well, they've come a long way these days in treating it. And as a matter of fact, that's true, especially where chemotherapy is concerned. One study of nearly 3,000 women treated from 2013 to 2015 found that in those years, chemotherapy use in early-stage breast cancer declined to 14%. That's down from 26%. For those with evidence of cancer in their lymph nodes, chemotherapy was used in 64% of patients, and that's down from 81%. For more on this, we turn to Dr. Jill Kolesser, a professor of pharmacy at the University of Kentucky, specializing in oncology precision medicine. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Kolesser.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I was prompted to reach out to you after reading an article in the New York Times that was headlined, "Cancer Without Chemotherapy, A Totally Different World." Does that headline accurately reflect what you're seeing and experiencing in your work?
Yes, I think across almost all tumor types, the use of chemotherapy is going down.
Was the arrival of genomics technology a turning point in this treatment?
Well, I think that's very much true. What we've learned about cancer over the last 25 years is that cancers are caused by specific mutations that occur only in that cancer. And technology has advanced so much now that for most patients who have a cancer, they can have their tumor tested to find out what mutations are present there. And the other important advance is once we were able to identify these mutations, the pharmaceutical companies and other places have developed a lot of new drugs that are specific to those different mutations. So what that means to a patient, instead of getting chemotherapy that, you know, 25 years ago, again, we gave to everybody, you can get an individualized treatment that is targeted to work specifically in your cancer.
So where in the past it might have been kind of like hitting the broad side of a barn, it's really pinpointed now. Is that an accurate description?
I think that's very accurate. Right now what we're doing is we have these new drugs. They only work in the tumor. So instead of causing side effects across the whole body, these drugs work mostly in the tumors, and so they both work better and they have less adverse effects.
What types of cancer are now being treated with these alternatives to chemo?
Well, you've read quite a bit about breast cancer. So breast cancer actually kind of led the way with this. We've known in breast cancer about particular targets and estrogen and Herceptin. So that has been evolving over the last 25 years. But closer to home, lung cancer is really a disease that's been transformed by precision medicine, where 15 years ago, everybody got standard chemotherapy. Now we have these targeted agents, and we also have drugs called immunotherapy that can be used.
Have these new therapies resulted in improved survival rates?
Yes. Universally, when we compare these new targeted therapies to the standard old chemotherapy, they have better responses and better survival. In addition, they universally have less adverse effects.
Dr. Kolesser, a barrier to treatment for many who live in remote areas of Kentucky is exactly that, distance, and the time and the effort it takes to get to a treatment center in, say, Lexington or Louisville. How does this new approach make a difference to these people?
Well, the tumor testing is available to community medical oncology practitioners. So those tests are available in the community. And if you can receive one of these therapies, they usually have less adverse effects. And so those can also be prescribed in your community settings.
In the Times article that I cited, Dr. Susan Domchak, a breast cancer specialist at the University of Pennsylvania, is quoted as saying that it's the nature of being an oncologist to be perpetually worried that you're either over-treating or under-treating a patient. Would you agree with that?
I do, and I think it really illustrates how much times have changed in treating cancer. When I first started in this 25 years ago, all we thought about is giving people more, giving them as many treatments as they could possibly tolerate, because unfortunately, none of the drugs really worked all that great. And now, when we have these new drugs that are so much more effective, we are actually starting to think about cutting back and giving less therapies. And, you know, I just feel like it's a major kind of a thought change that we've had in oncology.
That's really interesting. And I'm sure it's just forever evolving. The science of oncology is evolving. Is there anything on your radar right now that excites you that might be coming down the pike kind of soon?
Well, we're really excited about CRISPR-Cas9.
Yes.
And so that is a new kind of therapy where we start by figuring out what genes are a problem for the cancer. And then it's called gene editing. So basically cutting out the bad genes and putting in the new ones. That's actually in clinical trials right now. We're opening our first clinical trial at the Marquee Cancer Center with a CRISPR-Cas9 technology. So we're really excited. We're really, really excited about this as a potential therapeutic advance.
And just to drive home how revolutionary that would be, we're talking in real time here. You can actually make a change in a person with this technology.
Yes, that's true. And it actually is only within the cancer itself, not in the whole person, mm-hmm. So just in the cancer.
Amazing. How far off do you think we are before we'll see that used in practice?
Well, sometimes that's hard to predict because it's an early phase testing right now. But if things went great, maybe 3 to 5 years, and if things don't go great, maybe quite a bit longer.
Well, we'll hope for the shorter time, for sure. Dr. Jill Kolesser, professor of pharmacy at the University of Kentucky, we thank you so much for spending time with us.
Again, thank you for having me.
We hope to talk soon with the leader of the CRISPR clinical trial underway at UK. In the meantime, here's Dr. Rodolphe Barangu. He's a CRISPR pioneer at North Carolina State University. In a 2018 interview for the annual AllTech One conference, explaining how this technology works and what it means.
So in nature, CRISPR is the adaptive immune system in bacteria. And what scientists have done is repurpose the molecular machines from this primitive immune system in bacteria and turn that into a technology used for genome editing. And essentially, those molecular machines are equivalent to scalpels or razors that can specifically, efficiently, and accurately target DNA and cut it. And what happens when you cut DNA is that the endogenous DNA repair pathways come in and repair the DNA cut. And precisely at the point of cleavage of that DNA, the repair pathway will change the DNA sequence. This is why it's called genome editing. You are rewriting, you are altering, you are changing the DNA code precisely at the site of cleavage, which means now you can rewrite any genome you want, any way you want.
And can this be done in real time in living organisms?
So this can be done across the tree of life. You can do that in primitive things like bacteria or viruses or yeast, small organisms and microorganisms. And you can do that in any type of cell in which you can deliver DNA. We can talk about crops, plants, we can talk about animals, and we can talk about mammals like humans.
So let's imagine we might want to enhance the genetic code of crops, or livestock, or even people. So do you just snip this unwanted gene out in a crop, animal, or person and replace it with a good one?
So if you think of DNA as the book of life, right? You can do a word version of genetics. You can control F and look for any sequence you want. Let's say a faulty gene that you don't like in a patient, or a trait you don't like in a particular plant or an animal. You can look for that sequence, find it, and cut it. And once you cut it, you can do the edit that you want. You can remove it and take it out. You can replace it with another variant, another version, another allele. So if you think you have a typo, for example, in your genetic code, you can correct that typo to the right version. Or you can actually take a word out, or take a whole sentence out, or add a word or add a sentence, which means that you don't just change a gene. You can take out a gene. You can add a gene. And then CRISPR technologies are sophisticated enough to not just alter the genetic writing, but also the punctuation. You can change how loud genes are expressed. You can make them very quiet, or you can make them very loud. You can change the structure of DNA as well. So it's not just changing the letters per se. It's changing the punctuation and the narration of that genetic code.
Okay, this is really profound. If I can walk you back a little bit in time to when you first heard about this and began to investigate it, it must have been mind-blowing.
So actually, I'm one of the few people in the world who worked on CRISPR long before it was famous. Mm. So my first CRISPR patent dates all the way back to 2004, maybe the Dark Ages, or, you know, the Middle Ages, or the prehistoric era for CRISPR. And at the time, you know, people really didn't care much what CRISPR was or how it worked or what it did in nature. That being said, though, in the past 5 years, we've seen a transformative, disruptive evolution of that technology, because the CRISPR science has been repurposed for a different role, to edit the DNA of pretty much any species or organism you can think of. This is where the mind-boggling, quote-unquote, implications come into play, because now it's not just a cool idiosyncratic biological phenomenon. It is a very powerful technology and a very enabling technology that doesn't just enable scientists in academia to do those things, but pretty much any average-level PhD geneticist across the world to tinker with the DNA of the organisms they're interested in. And there are tremendous business implications, commercial implications, but also societal implications and ethical implications with regards to how this powerful technology should or should not be used, and should or should not be regulated, and should or should not be harnessed.
That's Dr. Rodolphe Barangu, a CRISPR pioneer at North Carolina State University, in a 2018 interview that I did with him for the annual AllTech One conference. It takes some real courage to get up on a stage in front of people and perform a cover of a Stevie Wonder song. Where music is concerned, Stevie is, after all, from some other planet or dimension. So there will be a lot of courage on stage at First Presbyterian Church in Lexington on the evening of November the 5th. And here to tell us all about it is fellow Wonder fan and First Presbyterian Director of Music and Arts, Marlon Hurst. Welcome, Marlon.
Thank you.
And so, to give listeners who may not be familiar with the series, which you produce along with Anita Courtney's Purple Carrot Productions, an idea of what we're talking about here, tell us about previous tribute concerts.
Well, the tribute concerts are housed within the First Presbyterian's Music for Mission series. We are launching our 13th season of Music for Mission concerts, but I believe this is the fifth tribute concert. And a few years ago, Anita approached me, not even thinking about Music for Mission, but asking if I would like to help her co-produce Leonard Cohen tribute the year after his death. And I said, well, you know, I have this concert series at the church that might work well for. And so we launched that, and because she and I were both Leonard Cohen fans, and we thought that would be a good concert. And so it turned out that it was very popular. It sold out. We did an encore presentation at the Lyric Theater. And after that first one, we thought, this is a winning formula, so we should continue to do this. And the next year, we paid tribute to Joni Mitchell, and the year after that, Bob Dylan, and last year, on his 80th birthday and the 40th anniversary of his death, John Lennon. So that brings us to this year, which is Stevie Wonder.
Right. And so I want to ask you, why did you come around to Stevie?
Well, first of all, any artist that we want to cover needs to has to be fun for Anita and me. Since we're co-producing this, we both have to be fans of the musician and like the music.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really after the Bob Dylan show that we started reflecting, saying, you know, we really should pay tribute to an artist of non-European descent. When we started thinking about, you know, non-European descended musicians, we created a list, and then Stevie Wonder rose pretty quickly to the top. His catalog is vast, and it's varied, and it has cross-cultural appeal. And so we thought he was the natural person to pay tribute to for this concert.
Well, briefly as you can, who are these brave souls who are going to be getting up on that stage on November 5th?
Well, I'm telling you, we have everything from a group of young men from Louisville called the Trip J Band, and they're all adolescents and pre-adolescents who really know how to play, to Jocelyn and the Sweet Compression, which is a Lexington-based band, but has national touring and is getting some recognition. And then folks in between, Bruce Lewis Quartet, Neve Eam, which has Marilyn Roby from the Bats, and also Ben and Margie Karp from the Philharmonic. Art Sheckett is in that as well, and so is Raleigh Daly. And Doc Feldman, a group that was called the Radical Departures, that they were formed for the purpose of performing in these tribute concerts and have continued to perform year after year. So it's a great variety of genres and ages and abilities, but they're all wonderful performers.
And this will be live, in person, and live stream, correct?
That's correct. We're still operating at First Presbyterian. We're still operating with some COVID protocols in place. So our capacity is reduced. And so that means that tickets are limited. So in order to have the widest viewership and widest participation as possible, we're also going to live stream this. There's no charge for the concert because it's part of the Music for Mission series. People will be asked to make a contribution to our benefiting social outreach partner, which is the Central Music Academy.
And do you need people to register or something so you get a head count, or is it just show up?
Well, no, tickets have to be distributed, and right now all the tickets have been distributed. So at this point, either tickets will become available maybe the week prior to if anybody turns them back in, or the best route at this point is to tune in to our Facebook feed.
Okay, that's Marlon Hurst, First Presbyterian Director of Music and Arts, on the latest in the Music for Mission series of local artists covering the works of icons of the music world. Thank you so much, Marlon.
Thank you, Tom.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Wendy Barnett, producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, and on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.